7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition. We have liftoff. Out and about is a go. All systems are nominal. Well, welcome aboard, out and abouters. You are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane on 88.1 and 92.3 FM or streaming from KYRS.org. I am your host, Maeve, and today we've been talking about this project for such a long time. The stage left production of Julius Caesar. And I want to welcome everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you.
Oh, and that, Deborah, you can use that mic if you want
Okay.
Oh, that, yeah. In fact, you guys just switch. Sorry, I should have caught that. Just shift over that way. That mic doesn't work. It's in case we ever get broken in and somebody tries to hijack the station and give out bad directions. We say, use that mic.
Take the bad.
And then we thwart their plans. In the meanwhile, then I escape out the back.
Without telling my
guests what's going on. So, why don't, Deborah, you want to kick it off and we'll just kind of go around and introduce ourselves? And
sure.
Who do we play in Julius Caesar?
My name is Deborah Marlowe and I am playing Julius Caesar in Julius Caesar.
All right, I'm Emma Woodward and I play Metellus. I play one of the guards and I play just a general inmate.
Just a general inmate.
General inmate.
I'm Chelsea Duvall and I'm the director choreographer of Julius Caesar. And sound designer, too, actually.
Yeah.
That's mostly what I'm doing right now.
Yeah. And, you know, Chelsea, you and I talked about this project probably a year ago, right?
Yeah. I keep telling everyone that Jeremy and I put this on the map a long time ago, like a couple years.
Yeah. I remember I was on the board and we were talking about it at Stage Left. Why don't we, now I think everybody probably knows what Julius Caesar's about, I suppose. Maybe not. Maybe they think it's a romantic romp. I don't know. But Chelsea, why don't you tell the story of what is different about this Julius Caesar production? And I also kind of want to know why you went down that road.
So the context of our production of Julius Caesar is set in sort of a dystopian world that has turned to like tyranny and dictatorship. And much like patterns of this in the past have interned populations of women, trans, and queer individuals, maybe they've committed real crimes, but they're problematic and subversive under this government in some form of fashion. And that is the context for ours, is we're in this internment center where these individuals have been sent indefinitely. And with all communities that have to survive, hierarchy arises in order to preserve the things that they need to help them survive. And with all things that happen with man, it is not always perfectly executed.
Well, and you know, and that's interesting because I think when we first talked about it, it was going to be in a women's prison.
Yeah.
But I like the internment camp. It probably is more fitting for today.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people, it's sort of, I think, in between prison and internment camp. Like I said, some of these characters are real criminals who've committed actual crimes.
Yeah.
But some are being interned for just speaking out against the government, for their very existence as an individual, whatever the thing may be. So prison, right, and internment is kind of enmeshed.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And Deborah, you're Julius Caesar. And so what's your backstory on this Julius Caesar?
My backstory is Julius Caesar is in this internment camp, this prison, for tax evasion. And, Julius Caesar is, used to being in control and commanding the environment around himself, herself, and she does the same in prison too, to a certain extent. Well, at least up until the Ides of March,
then
things kind of change. But
no spoilers. What happens in the Ides of March?
Yeah, beware.
The calendar turns a page. That's what happens.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of an interesting twist because, like in the original, it's still the original, but in I guess the traditional setting, Caesar is kind of seen as this maybe flawed hero in a way. And
absolutely, and, yeah.
But you're already starting off that you're in jail for
we all are.
Yeah, for this tax evasion.
Yeah.
Did the character sort of, as you've played it, have you found things about the character that you were kind of surprised about and developed more as you went into it?
Yeah, I did a lot of research on the historical figure to start,
yeah,
as the launching point. And what I learned about Julius Caesar, the actual Julius Caesar, was that he was very well liked by his men and by the populace at large. So he wasn't like an evil figure. He, yeah, didn't do anything bad. He was arrogant. He was prideful. He was vain. But he was also in the trenches with his men, with his soldiers. Yeah. And they loved him for that.
Yeah.
He, you know, would sleep where they slept. And he would eat the same food they ate. So he was one of them. And they loved him for that and respected him for that. And the populace liked him. The ones that didn't like him were the senators, the politicians. And what made him so scary to them was he was popular with the military and he was popular with the population at large. Yeah. And that therefore, made him very dangerous.
Well, it was a threat. And he was like a true populist, I guess. I mean, in the beginning, if I remember right, the beginning of the play, it's like he's coming back from a battle, right? And the crowd is really...
supportive.
I mean, joyous.
Yeah. Oh, they love him. Absolutely.
Winning this battle and the politicians, if I remember right, are kind of like, well, wait a minute. They just sort of, the population used to be for the people that we liked, and now they're going with this.
That's
Julius
right.
Caesar
That's right.
Character.
And that made him very dangerous in their eyes because they have their own fiefdom of power.
Yeah.
And he was a real threat to that.
Okay. Okay. And Emma, you get to jump around a lot.
I do.
Yeah.
I'm very busy during the show.
So do you have a lot of costume changes in this thing?
Yes.
Okay.
And we ran through all of our costume stuff for the first time last night, and I've got a couple ones that are pretty quick. So a lot of costume changes, a lot of transitions, moving pieces of our set around.
Oh, sure.
So, yeah, I'm very busy during the show. I play these three characters and then am helping out backstage, on stage, in between scenes.
Well, then you also have the job of becoming a completely different character.
Yes.
And the way you act, the way you walk and talk and all that stuff. Does that take you a while to sort of gear yourself to those quick changes in presentation as well?
We've been working on this show for the past few weeks, and I think just through our rehearsal process and in working with Chelsea, since Chelsea is a very physicality-oriented director, I was able to like find these kind of grounding points for myself in each of the three distinct characters that I play. And then I could, from there, create three separate people who look and stand and walk and speak differently, even though it's me as the actor in all three of them. But there are, I think, very clear distinctions between the three.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would assume so.
And Metellus, of course, is one of the conspirators. So right now, Deborah is sitting next to her demise.
My nemesis over here.
Bad blood. When you adapted this script, did you change the pronouns or did you stick with the...
Yeah, so there is some changing of pronouns. That was probably one of the largest
changes. Yeah, I was going to say, that's got to be a big...
Just because it was really clear to me that I wanted to embrace identity in a way that was like more forward thinking and inclusive. Yeah. And I did like deliberately pick a show that is more male heavy. I mean, literally there are like 2 to 3 females in this entire thing traditionally.
Right.
And so, yeah, I was like, that was like the larger thing. And Preston Loomer helped me a bit with the adaptation and the changing of the pronouns, which was really helpful. Because some things remain, like mankind, instances of that, right?
Yeah.
And still referencing, which I think is relevant because all of these women and individuals outside of the walls of the internment facility are still subjected to a male-dominated fascist state. So yeah. Some of that is, it still creeps in.
Yeah, and I would think, because you don't, it's not just a matter of changing the he's to she's and all that. You've got they's in there as well, right?
There are some they's for sure. I was really interested to hear, like, with the actors, like, how they identified and how that might, you know, communicate with character pronouns.
Yeah.
So, but I think we did pretty well. Like, I think towards the front of the process, I was like, if you feel like this character exists more as a they, them, we can do that. Like, when we were kind of still sure. combing through things.
Yeah.
So there was some flexibility for them for sure.
Oh, very fun. Very fun. You've got some big crowd scenes too, right? Julius Caesar, was that, does it help having us kind of a smaller stage, like stage left stage,
you
to
know,
do it, or?
It's interesting because this is my first time actually directing on the stage left scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, man, that's
surprising. Stage. Like, I've acted on the stage, but I've never directed on it.
Yeah.
There are definitely, like, really cool limitations. I say cool because I think it's interesting when you have a challenge as a director. You're like, okay, I've got these giant crowd scenes and battle scenes, and I've got a very small, you know, proximity. How do I do that?
Yeah.
So I kind of just tackle it as, like, you know, yeah, an interesting limitation that I have to tackle with creativity. But I think we do pretty well. This is one of, I think, the larger casts that I've done, although I did Romeo and Juliet last semester, and that was roughly around the same number. So I think we have 13.
Okay.
And, you know, the nice thing is, on a small stage, not that many bodies feel like a crowd, actually. And I worked pretty closely with James Landon Seidel, who's our scenic designer, to make sure that we had a flexible space that could be inhabited by a lot of bodies and then also could be, like, pared down and adjusted to feel more intimate. Like, so, like, when we have scenes in, like, Caesar's cell or Brutus's cell, right, or the tent scene, right, they're all cells, remember? That there was that flexibility.
Yeah, I always like to see how they accommodate the stairway box.
Oh yeah, the flat little platform. Yeah, upstage left. Yeah.
Yeah. That one's always just kind of like, oh my god.
You have to embrace it. I think what James did was very intelligent, and I was like, I just need, you know, I need space and I need some levels, and you'll see what they did with that. And I think it was very clever. And I am definitely one of those directors where I'm like, if you give me a set, I'm going to have my actors crawling all over it. So there have definitely been times where the lighting designer is like, oh, they're over there. And I'm like, yeah, it's an open spot in the stage. Like, I'm going to use it.
the whole thing's there. Use that thing. Deborah, when you, I've seen you in so many different things. You're so accomplished as an actor. But I don't know if I've seen you in any Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have done some Shakespeare, but this is this the first Shakespeare locally? Well, during COVID, Stage Left did some online. Yeah, the Masterpiece Monologue. So I did do a Shakespeare piece at that time.
Okay.
But this is the first full Shakespeare production that I've done in Spokane. I was going to be in one locally last year until I broke my shoulder, but that's another story for another time.
Which one were you going to be in?
I was actually going to be in Macbeth in Coeur d'Alene.
Oh,
and 2 weeks before, chasing my dog in the backyard, fell and tripped on something in the backyard, chasing Max and
darn much.
Broke, yeah.
And shoulder's just the worst,
right?
Yeah,
oh, that was fun. It was a lot of fun.
It takes a long time to heal from that.
So this will be the first Shakespeare full production in this market, yes.
Okay.
I have done some Shakespeare before.
Yeah.
I did Twelfth Night, and I've done a couple of other ones, but I haven't done a lot. I haven't done a lot of Shakespeare.
Well, when you approach something like this, you know, that's a text that everybody knows, or not everybody knows, but Do you prepare in any different fashion than you would for, say, you know, like, you know, a musical comedy or something?
For me, I have to understand what I'm saying, first of all.
Yeah.
And that takes a little digging with Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So the first thing I do is translate. What am I saying in modern vernacular so I can have it in my head before I start tackling that gorgeous text? Now, one thing I wanted to mention, too, is Chelsea did a beautiful job in editing this piece, so it comes in at less than 2 hours, so
that's good.
It moves,
because it could be like, it could be as long as like almost 3 years, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I know. I had a friend who just told me last night, I saw Hamlet, it was 3.5 hours. I said, not this production. not us. Well, so it's been edited, trimmed really nicely. It moves along at a nice clip and keeps you fully engaged. So the first thing for me is to understand what it is I'm saying.
Okay.
Dig deep into the meaning. Then I can dig into the text. And the text is so beautiful because of just the way he uses alliteration and the way he uses just every, you know, factor of speech is so gorgeous. And once you start wrapping your tongue around it, it becomes easier and easier to work with. But for me, I got to understand in the back of my mind, what am I saying?
Yes.
Yeah, what is a fardle again? you have to know what you're saying.
Yeah.
So that's my first approach is translating and then working with the text, marking up the text like crazy.
Oh, sure.
You know, underlining all the verbs and circling all the alliteration and all those little things.
Well, I think
bring it to life.
I think that people, you know, who aren't familiar with Julius Caesar might think that, oh yeah, this is like a historical accounting and Shakespeare was very historically accurate. But you know, he wrote it in a particular political time of turmoil in his life and all that. So I don't, you know, it's kind of must be kind of interesting to kind of juxtapose those two things.
Yeah. He took some liberties with history.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He did.
All right. We're gonna do our 20 minute after the hour stuff. But the good news is I don't have to do 40 minute after the hour stuff anymore.
Oh wow. Only one.
So just one. Just
nice.
One. But I have a song as I load this stuff up, which I picked especially
just for this.
Just for this.
How fun.
Is it Let the Bodies Hit the Floor?
No. No, but it's along those lines, I would say. All right.
It could be.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be back in just a few minutes, everybody. Stay tuned.
Keep on.
out and about received support from Boots Bakery and Lounge, specializing in vegan bistro fare and gluten-free baked goods. Located in the Saranac Commons, 19 West Main Street in Spokane. Open 7 a.m. through 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 7 a.m. through 5 p.m. Sundays. Full menu and information at bootsbakery.com. Support for Out and About comes from Eastern Washington University Running Start, where high school students can earn tuition-free credit before graduating. Applications at ewu.edu/runningstart. Support for Out and About comes from the nonprofit Northwest Museum of Arts and Culture in Spokane. Now presenting Preston Singletary, Raven and the Box of Daylight, bringing the Tlingit creation story to life. And Fire, Rebirth and Resilience, exploring our region's major fires from the Great Fire of 1889 to today. More information at northwestmuseum.org.
U.S. citizens wishing to contact their representatives in Congress about legislative issues can visit www.house.gov. Click the representatives link for a state-by-state directory that provides web links and current contact information.
Hey, this is DJ Download from Inside the Hype Radio. Thousands of people choose KYRS as their radio station every week, and we want you to be a part of our family. Just text Give KYRS to the number 44321 and make KYRS your radio station.
This is your KYRS live and local calendar for September 8th through the 11th. Monday, Imagine Jazz at the Bad Seed, Skin Slicing Horse, and Flyborn at the Big Dipper, and the Mac Movement open mic with Free Time Synthetic at the Red Room. Monday and Tuesday, Open Jam at Jackson Street. Tuesday, the Doghouse Boys at the Osprey, and Aspen Kai and the All-Star Jam with Jerry Lee Raines at Zola. Wednesday, Time Baby, Standard Deviation, the Max Quartet, and Curtis G at the Kendall Yards Night Market, Jason Perry and Aki Fumikado at Zola, the Justin Priest Band at Bolos, open mic with Derek Hart at the Checkerboard, and the Roommates Jam at the Red Room. Thursday, Robert Vaughn at Arborcrest, Sammy Eubanks at Bulldogs, Dallas K at the Spokane Interstate Fair, the Johnson Brothers Blues Jam at Chan's Red Dragon, Hot Tuna at the Bing, Psychic Death and Poise at the Big Dipper, the Dirty Champions at PJ's, and Sugar Bear, Fern Spores, and Tomboy at the Chameleon. For an entire hour of local musicians, tune into Sounds of Spokane every Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
And we are back. We're talking with my friends from Stage Left Theater's production of Julius Caesar. Welcome back, everybody. I'm not sure what's really going on there, but some mirth. And we're kind of excited because here we're hosting, Stage Left is hosting the National Community Radio Station Convention here this weekend. It's going to be really cool. So it's going to be, yeah, anyway.
Busy times.
You know, and you know, one thing we should have done before we broke is let people know how they can get tickets or find out more about this production of Julius Caesar.
StageLeft.org.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So I think it's StageLeft Theater.
Yeah, StageLeft Theater.
StageLeft Theater.
Without open September.
And it's ER.
Theater ER.
We open September 12th, this coming Friday, and we run for 3 weeks. There's showings on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Sunday's a matinee. Thursday, Friday, Saturday are 7 p.m. shows, and I believe that Thursday is a pay what you will.
Oh, cool.
Which is great for students. I always plug that for my students and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of students, last time we talked, you were... you were teaching in Utah. Is that still a gig that you're going to do?
No, I am not. That's why you see me here before you.
Because you'd be back already. Yeah. Okay.
The Utah state government, they passed a $60 million cut in higher ed, which we kind of talked about.
Yeah.
So that went through.
Oh, it did.
And
okay.
$17 million went, USU was responsible for. So they actually dissolved the program that I was based in.
Wow.
But that was... before I opted to leave, because what they did before that was ban the pride flag, and the anti-DEI stuff was getting cracked down, and I was like, bye, Felicia. I'm leaving. Like, this is not the home for me. So it was, I went out there and I, you know, I actually kept my apartment here because I wanted to see like how it went for 2 to 3 years, because I knew that the culture of Utah is much different than, you know, here. And I, you know, as when you go into any job, you have to make sure it's a good fit for you.
Right.
And it was not. And that's okay. I left with amazing recommendations. I worked with some amazing people. My head of department, I was just so impressed with and loved so much. But now I'm adjuncting at Whitworth.
Oh, awesome. I bet your students were just brokenhearted, though, at the elimination of the program.
You know, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, I am not sure. I taught film and theater out there, and, you know, it was a different student demographic than I've had here in Spokane. Yeah. Much different, because it was a state school, and this school was also used to be a community college before USU acquired it. So it was like a different campus. So the student demographic was much different. They were great, though. It was really like, I feel like I learned a lot, and definitely made me want to go get my PhD in film. I love teaching film. It's like, that's so cool. Freaking good.
Do you do much work, film work at all?
Mostly just analysis, and then I and theory, and then I do screenplay writing. I have a screenplay writing group that they're all over the country. Actually,
oh, how
I'm
fun.
The only one in Spokane, and we like read each other's work every week and do feedback, and it's amazing.
Wow.
I love it. With this show, I haven't been able to, I'm like, I'll be back soon. I haven't been to the meetup lately.
Okay. All right.
So yeah, so I do that kind of stuff. And I've been in some film. I do more coaching for actors for film, because that's like some of my training.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a totally different, I mean, Deborah's nodding. Yeah. I know that Emma also knows, because Emma went to USC, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they have a large film program.
So
yeah,
that's right. Now I remember USC. Yeah. Now, did you... have you both been in films as well, too?
I have done some film work, yes.
Yeah.
You want
to? Yeah, I've done some local projects. I did a lot of student film work when I was down in LA at USC, where I did my undergrad. So it's definitely it's a very different medium from theater. And I think, like, now that I have had the chance to do both, like, theater is definitely where my heart is. But yeah, I mean, I just love acting, and I love getting to tell stories. So
it's all about stories, isn't it? Really?
Yeah.
And you know, this story of Julius Caesar, you know,
look at that. Look at that perfect transition. We just need to acknowledge.
Smooth.
Well, I'm going to go back. I'll forget about Julius.
Maeve, you're so good.
But, seamless. But, you know, it really, I think every, you know, there are productions of it done during World War II that were sort of like, you know, with a real almost fascist look to it with, I think, either Hitler or Mussolini. I can't remember, but.
Probably both.
Yeah, maybe both. And, but it's kind of, I don't know. I was sat down and started thinking, like, what are the parallels? But for me, they seemed a little muddied. What do you want to come up? Tell me what you guys think are the parallels for today.
I mean, to me, like, Shakespeare writes nuanced humans. Shakespeare writes nuanced, complex humans. I think one of the challenges of performing Shakespeare work is that it's often still executed with the idea of the archetype, and archetypes are less relatable sometimes.
And less interesting.
And less interesting. But I try to ground it all in like very like Western Stanislavski realism, and that much more nuanced. So for me, like when I read the story of Julius Caesar, there were a lot of parallels in terms of relationships and survival and how we respond to power as a collective, as individuals, which we are totally experiencing in this country now. There are vast polarizing responses to our current people in power, right?
Yeah.
So, but I think what typically happens with this play is that those archetypes are usually swung heavy into. So they see certain characters as villains and those as heroes, whereas I'm more interested in the gray.
Yeah.
And that's what makes, you know, that's what makes it an interesting play.
I think that's what makes Shakespeare timeless, too, is the characters and the situations are nuanced. The characters, I mean, he just knows human nature so well. I love what David Bullis said about Shakespeare. The more you read Shakespeare, you realize he knows you.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's what makes it so interesting and relevant for today. The other thing that's fun about Shakespeare, and you see it all over the country and really all over the world, it's so adaptable. You know, you can set it in a women's prison. You can set it in the World War II bunkers. I mean, you can do a lot of things with it because the story and the characters are timeless. The look into human nature is so uncanny and real.
Yeah.
So the setting of it can be changed and nuanced to reveal the characters.
Well, yeah. For Julius Caesar specifically, too, though, the fragility of government is never an unknown thing.
Yeah.
Right? Like, that's something is that people forget that in the new stages of a government or in new stages of an administration, there's a lot of fragility. Mm. And vulnerability in terms of, like, is it a sustainable, successful container or government for the people, right? Yeah. And that's something that I mean, that is universal, especially as we've seen certain parts of the world move away from colonization, right?
Right.
We push back against colonization. We have this new thing that we're going to go towards. It's always going to be fragile for a while, right?
Yeah.
How does the world rally around it to support it for success or otherwise, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think to me, I have a hard time because, like you were saying, the characters are so nuanced, you know. So you can just go down the line and say hero, villain for all the characters and say maybe a little bit of both, you know. But in our president right now is just almost like a cartoon villain and not nuanced, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, there is nothing, you just kind of wish, like, show up with a puppy. Just do something that makes you more interesting. Because you're not an interesting person at all. You're just not nuanced. You're just like totally like a not a villain that's totally so over the top, unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's I think why I was having a hard time kind of like, okay, this could be this person, it could be that person, you know, I have a hard time doing that with this.
Well, American culture though, right? Our society and our history and capitalism really needs the hero, right? We need the forward momentum, the thing. So it's something that's really firmly grounded in the mythology of our society. So it's easy for us to go there. It's easy for us to look at plays, at things, and go hero, villain, you know, all
reduce
that stuff.
Reduce it down to that.
Yeah, yeah. And I go back to, I think that's why it's often limited in its portrayal with archetypes.
Yeah, I can see that.
Because, like, I don't want to go to a Shakespeare play where, like, there's just a... Well, first of all, I'm not interested in heroes whatsoever.
Yeah, you don't want to get preached at either.
Yeah. Because it's an idealization. Remember, also, heroism is connected to idealization. And, man, we're so good at that in our culture.
Oh, it makes things so easy.
Yeah.
You know, you put these things in this box and you think about... Yeah. And I think with this crowd, you know, I think in the United States, we're kind of going to a... The crowd, if you think of as the people of Rome, of being a character themselves, that this character is a volatile, dangerous character in this play, right? I mean,
Emma can speak to that. I mean, she's part of the ensemble who play
speak
the people
to it, Emma.
Yeah.
Play the people of Rome.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's that scene right after kind of the main event of the play. I don't know if we're spoiling things.
It's a good way to say it.
I love
it. The main event of the play.
Yeah.
Where Brutus speaks to the people of Rome, and they are kind of brought onto Brutus's side, where very quickly they kind of glom onto that, Brutus is in the right. And then Mark Antony speaks. And the whole crowd shifts to join Mark Antony. And Antony speaks for quite a bit longer than Brutus.
Yeah.
and is able to kind of get these people to rise up
and shift
into this almost feral kind of force of, oh, we're now with Anthony and we're against what just happened and we're willing to do whatever it takes, whatever it takes for us to kind of get back to either where things were or to take revenge on what just happened.
Make things right,
for sure.
Yeah.
I was definitely interested in mob mentality within this production.
Yeah.
Probably also because some of the research began in prison and in internment camps. And I've been thinking about the collective. I think we've all been kind of thinking about the collective for a little while and watching things happen and what is the power of the collective? And also, what is the vulnerability of the collective, right? Can a collective be swayed to engage in things that they think is for their own good but is truly not?
Yeah.
That's so much on my mind. We could go down a long little rabbit hole of working class and right-wing politics and the collective. And I'm like, why do these people not like unions?
I was thinking about Brutus, too. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen Julius Caesar, but it seems like, doesn't Brutus sort of, in his speech, try to buy off? Does he promise money to the citizens of Rome?
No.
Is there something?
Caesar leaves. Caesar actually leaves.
Caesar gives him the money.
Caesar leaves.
That's right. Okay.
Caesar has a will, right? That's part of what happens with Antony. No, Brutus, Brutus sort of tries to, a bit logically, it's almost like emotionally, logically, justify actions that have been taken.
Follow me down this path. I got here.
Yeah, and I weep as you weep, and trying to, in a way, make himself, or in this case, herself, a part of the collective in order to sort of curtail justification, and Antony really speaks from more emotion for sure. And I mean, it's a very smart scene and it's a lot of speech. And yeah, Emma was right. Brutus speaks for a little while and then Antony speaks for a long time.
Yeah. They're like, okay, enough.
It's chilling the change. I have an interesting vantage point when that conversation is happening, when those two conversations are happening. So it's chilling to hear and feel what happens to the mob when those two give their speeches.
Yeah.
And it is visceral. You can really feel it.
It's, it reminded me too, when I think of these significant historical figures that have passed, I have this weird fascination with the royal family. I always have, I just think it's really interesting, and probably because my family's from, the UK. But when Princess Diana died, how entirely grieved the people were. Yeah. And there was such an emotional dissonance between the people and the royal family. Mm-hmm. and the government sort of acknowledging this emotion and this power of the people, of her influence over the people, and the royal family really, really not being present with that not responding very well. That's another time in history where we kind of see this, right?
Right.
I
just kind of think about this mob being so active and listening, and maybe discerning is too strong of a word, but basically weighing things out and then prone to action. And I think historically crowds have been prone to action, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know about us anymore. I don't know what speech would be given. I mean, and maybe that's a good reason to see this play, is to see, to be reminded of that we are participants in that, in this, and that we're not just passive observers.
Another good segue, Maeve. Thank you. Yes. There's another reason to see the play.
I do think that there is some, I certainly think that since I kind of go back to the time during COVID and Black Lives Matter, I do think that as a society, we are still in this moment of the collective needs to act and the collective trying to act and the collective acting. Like, I do see that we are there in some respects. But I think since the civil rights movement in the United States, we haven't had that level of participatory collective power, right? I mean, that was astounding, and what was accomplished during that time in history.
Yeah, well, you know, the good thing about this, and I'm always this silver lining kind of person, maybe in this time, maybe this will be the thing that will make us be more participative, and I'll also see this moment where we can all get behind a collective action.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, I think so. I think that is happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Well, we never know.
It's, but you know, it's weird because it's like people can paint themselves into such a corner that, what do they call it? The binding power of atrocity, where people can, if you're complicit in some of this stuff, you will never surrender. You will fight to the death because you have done things that are so awful that you know that you're going to be strung up like Mussolini. You know, I mean, so anyway, yeah, I think we strayed a little bit off the play here a little bit. But.
Okay, but you have a brilliant segue in you. I know you do.
Okay.
Bring us back, Maeve.
strung up like Mussolini.
Speaking of string cheese.
Oh, yeah. That's what I was going to say. Stage Left now has string cheese that you can buy during an admission.
Do they really?
No, not really.
No.
But, you know, I was desperate.
String cheese is a great segue always.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah, that's so funny. I was thinking string cheese. So why don't we let people know, again, how they can come and see the play?
StageLeftTheater.org to get tickets. We run through the 28th of September, so September 12th, this Friday through September 28th, as Chelsea said, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And the only other thing I wanted to mention was, and maybe people know this, but just as a reminder, so when Shakespeare wrote for the theater, women were not allowed on stage. And the female roles were played by young boys or men. And so it's so interesting now to have all the roles played by women. It's just an interesting kind of turn on the tables.
I prefer it. I prefer it. I literally had an interview with the spokesman this morning, and I was commenting on this. Like, she's like, how did you come to this? And I was like, well, Jeremy just was like, we want you to do a Shakespeare. And I'm like, okay, well, I want it to be all women and trans inclusive. And I just love it. I really do love it.
Yeah.
It's so, and not that I don't appreciate and love male actors, but it's so interesting to translate these voices through a different lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a lot of work for a director too, because I think in just about every Shakespeare production I've been in, they have said, well, how would you like to play your character? Would you like to play your character as female, male, trans? And I'm like, I'll play the character however you want me to play the character.
Interesting.
You know? And then I've gone down the road where it's like, oh, I'm trans, let's just play it as trans. And then you start seeing all the work that has to take place. And I'm like a little apologetic, like, hey, you know, I it's okay. I could play it as a man if you want. And nobody's ever taken me up on that. But
It's so interesting that you say that. And I want to say, like, I mean, it's good that people are dialoguing with you about that. But for me, I cast who's in the room.
Okay.
Like, I always cast who's in the room.
Okay.
I'm like, this person identifies as this. This is what they're comfortable portraying. I think that's really important, especially because now our conversation around identity and gender and sexuality and all of this stuff is much more progressive, and it needs to be so more so in the theater and on stage.
Yeah.
So, like, to me, I'm just like, who are you?
Right.
Who are you, actor? How do you identify?
Yeah.
And there were lots of conversations around this, because obviously part of the thing I was interested in was how queer and trans individuals, right, and communities are have been interned historically in different situations in history, yeah. right? And so it was important for me even more so to have those voices in the room. But I think theater is still, I think sometimes theater is still trying to figure out those things.
Yeah.
But for me as a director, I'm always interested in who's in the room. Actually, I think I told you this. I directed, we talked about Lend Me a Tenor, right? Last fall, yeah. I was like, bleh.
Yeah.
I was like, Ken, like, I mean, come on. But there was a student there who had never been in a play before, typically did sound design, really wanted to audition, trans student. And, I had the conversation, like, how do you identify this way? Okay, great. Like, that's how I'm going to cast you. Does that feel comfortable? And it was a really interesting and beautiful thing because they had never been able to fully represent their gender, even out in the world. And through this role, they were able to, and their parents came to see it, and their parents had never seen him this way. And it was like in the middle of middle of nowhere, Utah, this really incredibly talented and awesome trans actor, and they just needed permission and yeah. space, you know? And I'm like, yeah, dude, that was easy.
Yeah.
No, I think it's more damaging, honestly, to have someone go against what they identify as. I think that's problematic.
Well, I think there also is the thing too, and this is why I'm always so grateful with the Shakespeare, like Shakespeare, where we can mm-hmm. change, we don't have to consult with Shakespeare. We can do whatever we want.
We love the public domain.
Yeah. And
The Price is Right.
The price is right.
It is. But I love that. You know, my dream would be that it's not a novelty to have trans people.
Yes.
That it's just like, oh, you know, the wife is played by so-and-so who's a trans woman, you know, and it's just not a big deal. And it's just a small character, and it's just like, it's not...
No.
It's like, well, were you affected by their performance? And that's about it.
But the funny thing is there's still because the dramatic literature lexicon is so heteronormatively coded, yeah. it's still a novelty to have trans voices included and portrayed. It's still a novelty to have lesbian relationships. Like, that's something we see in this play. That's like, when do we see that in any play? It's so rare. And queer relationships in general, right? So, right. Yeah, it is because it's still not, it takes us a little longer in the arts.
Well, and that's why, speaking about the queer relationships, I was going to ask you about Orange is the New Black. Was that kind of in your mind, back of your mind at all when you
I watched that mostly for like production-y things, like props and like what did right. they have. But I actually watched more documentaries. So like there's some documentaries on Netflix. Like I watched one called Jailbirds. I watched a bunch on YouTube. Because Orange is the New Black is a very particular
yeah.
comedic sort of farcical yeah. thing. I did think that one part of their season, though, one of the seasons down the road, right, the prisoners sort of have a coup and they take over.
Yes.
And that was, I did watch that section because what is chaos? How is chaos represented, right, when the world sort of turns? So I watched that, but I watched it more for design elements. Like,
sure.
Yeah, that's right. And activities.
Well, I just think, it's kind of going into a production, I guess. We've been so informed by Orange is the New Black. Like, yeah. this is the model, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You
I
know,
see,
and
see.
So.
Well, there's Oz, too.
Yeah, there is Oz, too. But I just think, I kind of wonder, I think I'm really looking forward to seeing this, and I'm looking forward to seeing.
Are you going to come on opening?
I don't know, and I'll talk.
Oh, because you have the conference.
Yeah, that's going on, and I'll tell you some other stuff that's going on afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Maeve and Chelsea catch up time.
Yeah, we'll have a little catch up.
A tete-a-tete.
Yeah, but I think that it's going to be really cool to see what you did with it and the choices you made, especially in the editing and what you left out and all that stuff. So
I think that there's many strong parts of this production, but I feel very lucky to have the actors that I have in this production, because I'm always wanting to do things a little differently and to be a bit more experimental. And I'm always wanting to push actors for growth. That's probably like the teacher in me, yeah. I think, right?
Oh, yeah, that's a great, great reason to do theater.
I'm like, hey, I don't want... Your laurels are great. Your laurels are great, but we're not going to rest on those. We're going to use your laurels, and then you're going to get more laurels.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of talent in this community that is already talented, but I'm like, ooh, but like, where could they go from here? I'm always asking that question. So I feel really lucky, because I feel like I have a really fearless, like down for anything kind of cast. They all love each other. I mean, you guys should probably speak to this. Yeah,
it is an ensemble piece, and it's an ensemble cast.
Yeah.
And don't you feel that way?
Oh yeah, for sure. There's something so wonderful going back to the cast and most of our crew being all femme or non-binary. We get to exist in a space where we can all kind of relate to each other on that kind of almost a more spiritual level,
yeah.
And connect on certain things that with more mask identifying performers, there might be more blurred lines or not as effective, like understanding on that level, but just getting to be a group of femme and non-binary identifying people, just in a room telling this story that is so generally, like when I think of Julius Caesar, I'm like, oh, it's a bunch of old white men.
We've seen the stereotype to be
a group of women telling this beautiful story and finding all the parallels to our kind of our experience of existing in the world has just been really special, and I'm very, very grateful to get to be a part of it.
Yay.
Yeah, it's a good group of humans.
How long have you all been rehearsing?
We started in June.
Well, we had a couple days in June, and then I had crazy contracts, and then we really started full-time in August.
Yeah, but when you were away, though, there was a lot of research being done.
Oh, of course.
A lot of research.
When I was away, yeah.
Yeah. You know, just some of the documentaries she mentioned and some of the programs we all watched, and, you know, that's where you start digging in, you know? That's where you start digging in.
Active rehearsals, though, sort of started beginning of August. Yeah. And it's hard. It's a hard, it's a crazy time or end of July, I guess.
Yeah, end of July. 21st, I think, of July.
It's hard to, hard time to do theater, too, because you're coming out of the summer. And so many people have, like, so many contracts and stuff. So this has been interesting. It's definitely been a cast with, like, the most, like, conflicts that I've had. But I will tell you, like, I was like, I don't care. I want him. I'll deal with the conflicts, which everyone is so graceful. Yeah. I feel like y'all are so graceful with each other.
Yeah.
Like truly, like somebody's out. We're like, okay, got it. We'll cover for them. And is it hard? Does it make the process a little challenging for the actors? Sure. But they've been really awesome with each other. And our stage managers are so good.
Who's managing?
Elizabeth Lewis is our stage manager.
Okay. Yeah.
And Faith Broadwater is our ASM.
Oh, yay.
And they're both, I think they do really well. And, yeah, I love it. I don't know. I love our little team.
Yeah, Elizabeth is fantastic.
Yeah, and I think Faith is just out of school.
Yeah, I don't think I know her.
Yeah, they're very young. And they are really like, I love Faith. I describe Faith as like very wide-eyed. Like they're young and they're taking in all of the things.
Yeah.
They have a good foundation for a lot of their management. But I think working with an experienced SM like Elizabeth is just going to really, I mean, like Faith in a couple of years going to be crazy good.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And that's such an important position.
Oh,
sometimes
so
gets overlooked.
Oh my gosh.
But a good stage manager is so much.
Break. And we need to be nurturing also new stage managers like
absolutely.
Faith. Like we need to be supporting these people because like literally we can't drive the car of a production without the gas in it. And the only one that puts the gas in it is really the stage manager.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. They set the tone. That's for sure. Well, I think that's we're out of time.
That's our time, Maeve.
I know. I'm sorry, but that's how time works.
It's linear that way.
But why don't we get just before we go, let people know one more time
William Shakespeare's Julius Caesar at Stage Left Theater, opening September.
Yeah,
September. 12th. Thank you. September 12th through the 28th. Okay. And we would love for you to come and see our show, everyone.
Yeah. Okay. You can go to stageleftheater.org, ER.org. Find out more. All right. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in Out and About.
Thank you.
Listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane. And I will see you next week in some fashion. All right. Bye for now.
Their Congress is easy, he writes. Quote, let's start by doubling their salaries. Excuse me, but let's not. While money is the reason Congress fails to represent the common good of America's workaday majority, their paychecks are not to blame. Rather, it's the corrupting power of the unlimited dollars that corporations and billionaires are spewing into our elections and lobbying campaigns, literally buying the special interest Congress that Americans despise. This is Jim Hightower saying, the obvious problem with Congress is not that members don't get enough money, but that they take too much. Don't even think about raising congressional pay before outlawing congressional payoffs. Besides, anyone who'll only commit to public service work if their pay is doubled is not committed to the public, to service, or even to work. They are narcissists committed to themselves, and Congress already has an excess of those. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
Hi, you're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1
and 92.3 FM.
KYRS Medical Lake and K222BG Dartford, 88.1 FM and 92.3 FM, Thin Air Community Radio.
The following program was pre-recorded.
Is Democracy Now.
Oversight Democrats just got a hold of the Jeffrey Epstein birthday book and note that, of course, was sent by Donald Trump to Jeffrey Epstein. This note, Donald Trump has said, does not exist. But once again, he is lying to the American public and is leading a White House cover-up.
The House Oversight Committees released new documents related to the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, including a 50th birthday book with messages from friends, including a note and sketch of a naked woman apparently signed by Donald Trump. As the White House faces growing calls to release the Epstein files, we'll look at a major New York Times expose about how America's largest bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, enabled Epstein's crimes and profited from him while ignoring major red flags. Then to Trump's threats to wage war on Chicago. ICE has just launched a major operation in the city days after Trump posted a message declaring Chapocalypse Now, a reference to the Vietnam War film Apocalypse Now, which contained this iconic scene.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
In Trump's message, he wrote, I love the smell of deportations in the morning. To talk about Trump's immigrant crackdown, the militarization of U.S. cities from Chicago to Los Angeles, and the film Apocalypse Now and his reference to it, we'll be joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, Viet Thanh Nguyen. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's escalating its attacks on Gaza City and has issued orders to forcibly displace the city's entire population of nearly 1 million people. On Monday, Israeli planes dropped leaflets ordering Palestinians to head to Al-Muwasi, a coastal strip of barren land Israel's designated as a so-called humanitarian zone, despite frequent deadly attacks on the area. Israel's latest forced evacuation order comes